This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, William Gibson, is the co-creator of the literary genre known as cyberpunk. It combines the futuristic setting of science fiction with the subculture of computer hackers, the predatory environment of crime fiction, and the attitude of rock and roll. Gibson's first novel, Neuromancer, won a Nebula Award, a Hugo Award, and a Philip K. Dick Memorial Award. His new novel, Virtual Light, is set in California in the year 2005. Gibson's work is so popular in the computer subculture, he played himself in a cameo role in Wild Palms, the recent TV miniseries about virtual reality. And there's no shortage of tributes from the rock and roll world. U2's Bono said his latest album was inspired in large part by Gibson's work. Deborah Harry sings a lyric by Gibson on her new album. Gibson coined the word cyberspace. I asked him what he had in mind when he came up with it.
I was looking for something that would, for me, could take the place of the horse in a Western or the spaceship in a 1940s science fiction novel. And so I came up with the interface technology that allowed people to enter, and then I came to a full stop, to enter what? And I remember sitting at a typewriter kind of typing, data space, no, info space, no, cyberspace. Cyberspace had a sort of ring to it, you know, and it has in fact proven to have legs. But when I did coin it, I was looking for a way to describe an iconic representation of all the stored data in the world, which operators of computers could enter or enter virtually and then navigate through, looking for the icon that represented whatever piece of information they might be after. The assumption being that the whole thing is worlds within worlds. So if you want IBM data, if you work for IBM and you want IBM data, you would go to the IBM icon, which let's say is a big blue ball. You would apparently enter it, and inside there would be other icons. They'd be three-dimensional shapes with colors, and you'd work your way down. It's sort of like the Dewey Decimal System. Actually, I do remember thinking of that when I did it. It's sort of like an easy way to find something in the library.
So you've told us what you had in mind when you coined the term cyberspace. What do you think it's come to mean now?
Well, it's a few of my favorite examples of what it might mean. It's the place where a long-distance telephone conversation takes place. It's where the bank keeps your money. It's increasingly the place where so much of the activity that we do that constitutes civilization takes place. The fact that it's not a real place and that it's utterly extra geographical is a bit confusing for some people. But, you know, when you go to the ATM, and when you go to the ATM and push those buttons, you're accessing a computer. When you do that, you sort of know instinctively that the thing that happens that results in you getting your money is not something that happens immediately behind the metal face of the ATM. But you don't know exactly where it does happen. You know, it goes away on a telephone line, and when you look into it, it turns out that it doesn't happen anywhere in particular. It happens in a network,
which is cyberspace.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it.
You wrote your first novel, Neuromancer, on an old manual typewriter. You didn't own a computer till you were able to use some of the profits from Neuromancer and buy one.
That's true.
So what interested you in that, you know, high-tech cyberspace world if you weren't really a part of it yet?
Well, you know, just when I was writing Neuromancer was when they started marketing home computers. And in a big way. So I knew that they were out there. I mean, there were a lot of ads for them, and it never really occurred to me to want one. But I thought it was an interesting trend that private individuals were buying these relatively small machines, although they were relatively huge when you look at them today compared to what we now have. I thought that was interesting, and these things had sort of disseminated enough into society that I knew some people who had them, particularly in the science fiction community, got very early into home computers. So I knew some people who had them, and they were very passionate about them. And in the early days of home computing, you had to know a bit. It really helped if you knew quite a bit, or as much as you could, about how your computer worked, because you learned very quickly that you could make your computer do all sorts of neat tricks that it couldn't really do when it came from the factory. And a lot of people had to write their own software, write their own code. So I knew some people who did that, and the passion they felt for it, it really captured my attention. It reminded me of the passion I'd seen people in the 60s show for psychedelic drugs, and it reminded me of the passion I'd seen mostly boys in the early 60s show for automobiles. So out of that, I think I got the idea of taking the hacker mentality. And in those days, hacker had no dark side connotations. Hackers were simply people who were really good with computers, sort of knew their way around them. So I took the hacker mentality and combined it with a sort of Bruce Springsteen, hot-rodding, loner mystique, and got the protagonist in Neuromancer. There are a few other parts to him, but basically, he comes out of an attempt to do that. I romanticized something that was not, at least obviously, romantic. I did it quite deliberately. And one of the things I do in Virtual Light, I think, is to try to go back and, to some extent, undo that, or at least provide a bit of perspective on it.
Undo the romanticism that you created in Neuromancer?
Yeah, because it's a decade later. I keep bumping into kids who sort of buy certain aspects of Neuromancer wholesale in a way that I find a little disheartening sometimes.
Like what? What aspects of it?
Well, even that they would want that, the idea that I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to go down as someone who had encouraged, generations of irresponsible young computer criminals. It doesn't, and I've actually been accused of that on a number of occasions. And when I wrote Neuromancer, as far as I knew, there were no hackers in the sense that there are now. I guessed that they might exist, or that they might soon come into existence, and because I knew a bit about the history of the phone freaks and the phone freaks who, just for the hell of it, would sort of run rampant through the global phone net, which is really a big computer system. It turns out that they had quite a lot of DNA in common with say the people who founded Apple, the people who invented the people who invented the home computing, were sort of drinking stale Dr. Pepper in the same pizza joint with these phone guys. So there's something there in common. But one of the kind of sub-agendas in Virtual Light involves presenting the evolved form of the outlaw hacker as a kind of really pretty creepy sort of terrorist slash gangster. motivated by essentially by selfishness and a desire to make money. This is very different from. It's not really very different from Neuromancer, but it's very different from a common misreading of Neuromancer.
Well, I imagine that a lot of hackers really appreciated the image change that you gave to their world. I mean, a lot of people thought of computer hackers as computer nerds, people with bad haircuts and no sex lives.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm sure they did. I mean, I think it must have delighted them. It sort of delighted me. I just thought it, you know. It was a very funny thing. It was a very funny thing to do, and I gave them permission to wear black leather and have girlfriends. Unfortunately, I think there's still lots of them who don't have girlfriends, and if they did, you know, they wouldn't have so much time to mess around with computers. You know, it would be better, but there's nothing to be done about that.
So, how close are you with computers now? I imagine you own at least one.
Yeah, well, we have bunches and bunches. My children now have better computers than I do. They need them for school. They need color screens and all that. and letter quality printers. I'm working on one that's now, I don't know, sort of 1980s model. Well, 86 model. But I'm not any more adroit with it or sort of up on it than I was before.
Do you belong to any of the computer networks?
No, I don't do email at all. It's apparently a lot of people don't believe that. And a lot of people on the internet would like to think that I lurk there, you know, omnipresent under some pseudonym. But I don't do it for a number of reasons. One is that given the kind of life I lead, I have a pretty extensive virtual community as is. It just happens to take place via long-distance telephone and faxes. I also have friends who do keep track of, who do spend a lot of time on the internet, and if they see something that they think I'd be interested in, they download it to their fax modems and fax it to me. But I get on the average day with sort of things coming in from various people, I get like 15 feet of fax paper out of that machine, and I scarcely have time to read that. So how could I ever sit down and at the end of a long day, you know, 9 to 5, sitting in front of my word processor, then I'll turn my word processor onto the modem and open my email, and, you know, how long would I be? I don't know. It's just it's not what I need to do. I think it's a terrific, you know, I think it's a terrific thing.
The New York Times had a front page story today about the internet as the new teenage hangout.
Yeah, and more power to them. I was in a place in San Francisco called the Horseshoe, which is a coffee house near the Haight, much favored by bicycle messengers and kids with tattoos and odd bits of metal through various parts of their anatomies, very kind of radical fashion kids. And they have laptops sort of crazy glued to the tables in this coffee house. And the kids come in and sit down and pay the waiter a few bucks and log on to the internet and get their mail and make dates. And I thought, this is really modern. I mean, this makes me feel old. Quite extraordinary. That's the only place I've ever seen that. I think that might be a trend, coffee houses with internet computers.
My guest is William Gibson. His new novel is called Virtual Light. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Gibson, author of the cyberpunk classic Neuromancer. You grew up in a small town in Virginia?
Yeah.
How did you like growing up in a small town? Were you anxious to get out?
Well, when I had been younger, up until about age 8, my father was in the contracting business in the sort of post-war, pre-Sunbelt South. There was a fair bit of building going on, so we traveled. We moved a lot, you know, sort of following these big jobs that he would be working on. And then he died suddenly in an accident. And my mother took me back to live in this town where both she and my father had come from and where their relatives had lived for generations before. And it was sort of like, for me, it was sort of like going back 20 years into the past. I was used to a more urban or suburban sort of existence. And suddenly I was in this place that was sort of lodged quite far back in time. And, you know, that was sort of pre-integration. That was the segregated South. And a pretty deep part of it, you know, that way down there in the mountains. And it was, I still feel kind of ambivalent about it. I guess because I had that traumatic experience of going there because my father had died and feeling sort of a stranger. And also the feeling of being sort of like the spaceman, you know, like I had just come in from some other kind of reality that was 10 or 15 years down the timeline, or it felt that way to me, and suddenly I was in this sort of bad place that I felt was like quite a backward place, and I never really got over that entirely. But I think it was a very useful experience for a science fiction writer. It always is to have that feeling of kind of shuttling through different times or different realities.
Did you read a lot of science fiction?
Oh, I read an enormous amount of it, or in any case, all of it that I could get my hands on, between age 12 and 15. After that, not so much. I found other things to do. Actually, I went off to a boarding school in Arizona and was able to have a much more active social life, and my interest in science fiction lapsed. Then when the 60s arrived with full force, I remember looking back at the science fiction I'd read and thinking, well, that's just not, you know, none of this stuff predicted anything as bizarre as what I'm experiencing today. So it's really not nearly as prescient as I would have thought when I was 13 years old. In fact, I was right.
What did you start writing?
Well, when I didn't start writing until my sort of mid 20s or a bit after. I actually started writing in 1976, and the first story I wrote has virtually all of the things that have subsequently come to be seen as sort of hallmarks of my work. It has them all there in some larval form. I can look at it and see it. It's got a bit of virtual reality and metaphors of memory, a sense of old social structures falling apart. I mean, it's sort of all, it seems to me like it's all there. And I look at that sometimes and think, very strange. It's very strange how that happens, because it wasn't conscious.
I still don't think I completely understand why you became so absorbed in the world and the fantasy of computers when you were such an outsider to it. There must have been something more that really interested you about it.
You know, to me, that aspect of writing science fiction is, I just think of that as the gizmo part. And it's, I mean, people find it hard to believe, but it's to me that's the easy part. You know, I can do that standing on my head. And to me, it wasn't what Neuromancer was even about. I mean, what I was consciously involved in when I was writing Neuromancer was working out some ideas I'd gotten from reading D.H. Lawrence about the dichotomy of mind and body in Judeo-Christian culture. That's actually what I was thinking about, and it's all in there, all of that wool gathering case does about the meat and what it needs. And the, I mean, in my reading of Neuromancer, the pivotal scene is an epiphany case has when he sort of has an orgasm in cyberspace with his former girlfriend, who's actually dead but has been recreated by an artificial intelligence. And to me, that's what the book is about. It's not really the standard reading. And everyone else says, yes, but what about the technology he was using when he did it? And it's kind of baffling for me. I mean, it doesn't stop me from writing, but it's such a teen boy reading of the text.
There's no shortage of rock performers who have acknowledged how much they've enjoyed your fiction and how it's inspired them. Deborah Harry on her new album has a song with music by guitarist and producer Chris Stein and words by you. Was this a song you collaborated on with Chris Stein, or did he set something you'd already written to music?
Well, they asked me to send them lyrics, and I sent them a bunch of, I'm sure, mostly totally unusable stuff, and they very cunningly and carefully pick the best bits and put it together so that they had enough for one very brief song. And it was really a thrill to hear it for the first time. Now, the first time you hear something you've written come out of Debbie Harry's throat, it's really great.
So what were you thinking of when you wrote this?
It's sort of like a blues song. If the world of Neuromancer had blues songs, that's what it is.
Right. Well, before we hear it, let me thank you very much for talking with us. And William Gibson's new novel is called Virtual Light. Thank you for being with us. And this is Deborah Harry from her new album, Deprivation. And this is the song Dog Star Girl with a lyric by William Gibson.
Maybe it's just a twist of light tonight, but the city's so bright, this whole town.
I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.